Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It's a great pleasure to be bringing you this show, and I intend to continue this show as long as I am able to speak, as long as I'm able to function. I will not stop, because someone's got to take out the dirty laundry. Is that the wrong analogy? Someone's got to take out the garbage. Whatever it is, I've got to do it. Someone's got to do the difficult stuff. Not everyone's capable of it. Not everyone has the opportunity to do it. And those of us that are called on to do it will do it. It's your duty if you are called upon to do it. And if you're one of those people out there that feels that, please get in touch with me, because we need you. Because there's a lot more that I intend to do with this show, and I would really, really appreciate your help if you've got skills that are relevant to this show. And some of the skills that we're particularly looking for are anything to do with writing. If you're good at writing, if you enjoy writing, if you like writing on politics, geopolitics, what's going on in the world, science subjects, cultural topics, anything that involves critical thinking and that basically has an attitude of mind that is willing to face harsh realities and tell people truths that they may have been denied, then we would like you to get in touch with us. Also, if you've got technical skills, if you're a great web developer, if you're a programmer, your skills would be greatly valued. If you are an audio engineer or a video production specialist, those sort of things are things I could really, really do with a lot of help in. And advertising and sponsorship is another area that if you've got expertise in there, if you're a PR specialist, we could certainly use a bit of help, because I'm going to be commercializing this show shortly, and I would really like to get some assistance from anyone out there who's got those kind of PR abilities, which is quite a difficult area, and I know some people are very good at it. So we need to get some funds in. We need to be able to raise the profile of this show. I want to be able to do more in-the-field reporting. And I want to have more impact. You know, it's just that simple. I just want it to be the best show it can possibly be. So anyway, I would like to continue now on the theme from the previous hour, where we were talking there towards the end about the asylum seeker issue. And, of course, Tony Abbott, our new leader of a new government, overturning 5 years of Labour Party, progressive left government. We now have the Conservative government, and we've got the tag team left-right paradigm game being played on us, and people are being moved left-right, 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 and constantly confused and bedazzled and hypnotized by what's going on, and they can't see the bigger picture. Well, the bigger picture, folks, is that the same people are in charge who've always been in charge. They've just got different front men, right? And the front men are just there to actually distract you. And Tony Abbott is a front man. So, but let's deconstruct the front man arguments about the people smugglers and stopping the boats, or turning the boats back, as they say. Why am I saying that's wrong? Why do I disagree with that? Why is turning the boats back the wrong thing? Well, it's the wrong thing for a very simple reason. That Australia is a signatory to the Refugee Convention, right? And that is actually a principle of our Constitution. We, as a people, will offer asylum to those who are in need. Now, of course, Tony Abbott isn't denying that, but he's at the same time, he's saying, well, we're going to turn the boats back. Well, there's a complete contradiction there, isn't it? You can't say, look, we're a compassionate country, we're going to grant asylum to those in need, and turn boats back at the same time. The reason they're able to do it through the legal technicality is that being a people smuggler is actually a crime. Being an asylum seeker is not, but being a people smuggler is a crime, and it is actually punishable by a prison term. Now, there's a big problem there. There's a big logical problem there. If it's legal to be an asylum seeker, and it's illegal to be a transporter of asylum seekers, then it's just a logical paradox. It's a game, isn't it? It's a word game. You can't say it's okay to be an asylum seeker, but anyone who brings you over here is actually breaking the law. What are you supposed to do, swim? I mean, you know, if you on a canoe, would the person paddling the canoe be the smuggler? I mean, I'm sure there's some very technical legal questions there about what the definition of a people smuggler is, and I'm sure it involves the exchange of money. But again, it's a service, and it's done at great difficulty, and it's also made more difficult by the threatening tactics that are used by various governments in their posturing and their chest thumping to prove how tough we are on illegal immigration, right? And they use that word, illegal immigration, to make it sound like what they're doing is they're dealing with scum, right? Whereas, in fact, they're dealing with refugees who are trying to escape from the countries that we, as part of the Western elite imperial armies, have crushed, abused, raped, and destroyed. But anyway, you know, they come and they take all these risks, and until fairly recently, apart from a few hiccups there and a few posturing moments there with the Pacific Solution and putting people on mosquito-infested, rotting camps on Nauru, most of the people who managed to make it to Christmas Island or thereabouts could be granted asylum in Australia. They would still be put in internment camps for a period of time, and there were still a lot of hurdles that had to be gone through. But once they reached Australian mainland, they had access to the facilities of a democratic, civilized nation. Well, Tony Abbott wants to turn all that around. He wants to turn the boats back. So the boats will be turned around and they'll be towed back. And that's it. And then it's up to the Indonesians to know what to do with that. I mean, the Indonesians, of course, allow the asylum seekers to be in their territory. They don't actually turn them back. Isn't that interesting? You know, because we're supposed to be the goody-goody country. Oh, look, we're so good. We take care of refugees. Well, what about Indonesia? They let them in. They don't turn them back. They just don't have a nanny state. You know, they don't collect massive taxes like we do. They're not actually able to house them and feed them the way we do. They don't particularly like having them there, of course not. But, you know, they don't turn them back and they don't shoot them. So there's just so much wrong with this whole concept of turning the boats back. And the base argument about it, that we have to protect our sovereignty of Australia, is a completely fraudulent argument. And I say that to you, that it's fraudulent, because we have a rapidly expanding population, which is not due to asylum seekers. It is due to government-controlled and authorised immigration, which is in catastrophic numbers. Let me read to you some figures here. And this is from Credit Suisse rating agency. It says here that the Australian population in the year to September 2013 grew at roughly 2%, the fastest percentage rate in the world. In the fourth quarter, actual immigration came in at 310,000. The official target is 190,000. So that's 120,000 extra people that we're bringing into this country. Now, I'm not in favour of that, folks. I think that's terrible. I mean, I think it could be managed. Maybe it's doable. But the way it's being done is an outrage. The way it's being done is a crime, both for the people in Australia and for the people that are being brought in here under substandard conditions. It's destroying our way of life in Australia. It's undermining everything that this country stands for. And you know what the refugee component of that is? I think it's about 10,000. I mean, in fact, that might be the total number that are waiting for clearance to be allowed in. 10,000 to 15,000, and that's the high figure. In previous years, it's been more like 5,000. Some years 2,000. The last couple of years, it's been high again because of all the imperial wars and everything that we're doing to destabilize countries like Syria. Most of them are now coming from Syria, right? But anyway, you know, 10,000 to 15,000, and well, where's the other 300,000 odd coming from? Oh, those are the official immigration numbers. It's ludicrous, folks. This is where the problem is. The problem here is in the immigration policies of the government, which, how strangely, no one is talking about. It's all a big secret, isn't it? I mean, you find out these little articles, you have to hunt around for them, and you find out that there's 310,000 come in last year, officially. Doesn't that make you angry? Doesn't that make you angry when you see Tony Abbott chest thumping about a few thousand refugees? You've been conned. You've been had. And basically, this is just really the wind-up phase, the end-game phase of a program of replacement, of it's a type of ethnic genocide which is actually being done by simply replacing the population. I mean, for example, our native population growth is extremely negative. It's way below 2.2, which is replacement rate. I think it's down at about 1.6, which means that Australians, born Australians, first, second, third generation Australians, we are a declining race. And if that trend continues at the same time as the vast numbers of people that are being brought in, we will be completely replaced as a people. And I do believe that is actually fully intentional. That is part of the plan. And there's just a little game being played here of left and right and worrying about non-issues like asylum seekers designed to make you afraid while they just continue with the plan. Now, one of the effects of this massive influx of people is, of course, housing shortages and outrageous increases in property prices that we've seen in Sydney, which is one of the major places where immigrants come. And again, it's making life impossible. It's forcing people to move into highly overcrowded, crammed living situations, which are very bad for your health, very substandard, very third world. And it means that house prices go up way beyond what most people can afford. And indeed, most of the houses are only now able to be bought by foreigners who come in here like millionaires from Hong Kong who can just buy a house in Vaucluse, you know, with a click of the fingers. Anyway, I hope that was of some assistance to you in understanding this whole topic. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'll be right back after this break with some climate change news. Don't go away. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Let's talk a little about climate change. It's been a while since I've weighed into the topic. I want to play to you a debate that was aired on a Fox News station, a show called Chill Out, by John Stossel. Now, I'm not a huge fan of Fox News. Of course, in many ways, they're cartoonish conservatives. In many ways, Fox represents the worst of the sort of Murdoch empire and the jingoistic right-wing American viewpoint. But at the same time, and this is again this part of the strange paradox of left and right, we often see through Fox News some of the more independent and truly revolutionary viewpoints being expressed by skeptics of official truths on many topics. And, of course, we've seen that with questions such as 9/11, where Fox News has aired critics of the official view about the collapse of the World Trade Center and a few things like that. So the question of climate change, of course, has been a big one on Fox. And what's good about the clip I'm going to play to you is that we actually get to see a bit of a debate. And we very rarely see debates anymore. And I think it's because those who represent the United Nations IPCC viewpoint basically won't debate. They never come across very well. They don't really have a very strong position, and it's certainly exposed when they do actually enter into debate that they just don't really have much to say. And that's certainly the case in this debate between Mark Morano, well-known director of Climate Depot, and a scientist by the name of Bill Nye, who I believe is like a TV scientist, not one of your leading sort of IPCC scientists. He may be more of an educational oriented guy who does stuff on TV. I'm not too sure, but anyway, this is quite an interesting little skirmish, and I think it really highlights the kind of the vacuum in the position of those who do adhere very strongly to the alarmist climate views, and also the way they cling to fears about population growth as being one of the main threats and one of the main sort of underlying arguments that they use is this Malthusian fear of population growth. And in this debate, you'll actually see that that is actually his main argument for why climate change must be real, because the population has increased. And it's a bit odd, because he doesn't even make the connection really very clear. He just says, well, you've got to accept that there's now 7 billion people on the planet. Ah, we're all going to be scared. So anyway, let's play to you this debate here from Fox News.
Title this program Chill Out, because after I researched the global warming scare, that was my conclusion. We ought to just chill out. But our government isn't chilling out. You now pay billions to try to fix global warming. And this year, The Hill, the Washington newspaper that covers Congress, said climate will be the political battle of 2014. Big money's being spent to convince Americans to vote to spend even more to try to stop global warming. In a moment, we'll hear from Bill Nye, the science guy, who says he's frantic about climate change. He'll debate Mark Morano of ClimateDepot.com. But first, let me set the terms of debate. People say to me, Stossel, you don't believe in global warming? But I do. I think it's a stupid question, because what do you mean when you say global warming? To me, it's really four questions. One, is the globe warming? Well, yes, global temperatures have risen, though not lately so much. Question two, is the warming man-made? Is it our fault? Three, is it a crisis? And four, if it is, can we do anything about it? Bill Nye's answers to those questions are yes, 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 and yes. And for years, he's told his viewers, beware of
what we call global warming. Global warming. The globe is getting too warm. And something we've got to be careful of. Otherwise, things could get weird.
Bill Nye joins us now, along with climate change skeptic Mark Morano. Mark, you first. Why aren't you scared, Bill? And lots of people are.
we're now able to empirically look at their predictions that they made in the 80s and start to see them fail. And out of 117 climate models, one analysis showed 114 failed. So when the predictions are failing them, they'll still claim it's worse than they thought, but that's not the case here. So the bottom line is the burden of proof is on them, and they've failed to make the case.
Bill Nye?
In the year 1750, there were about 1 billion humans in the world. Now, there are well over 7 billion people in the world. It more than doubled in my lifetime. So all these people trying to live the way we live in the developed world is filling the atmosphere with a great deal more carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases than existed a couple centuries ago. It's the speed at which it is changing that is going to be troublesome for so many large populations of humans around the world. Now, you may have heard of the hockey stick graph. This is where we compare the temperature of the world over the last 10,000 years with the temperature now. And so we think of that as
the shaft
of a hockey stick. Well, it is shooting up. It's not going to. It is shooting up. And so it's the speed that we're going to have difficulty dealing with.
But temperature hasn't increased in the past 15 years. It isn't shooting up.
When you cherry pick the data for certain surface temperatures, you end up with a very small change. It's hardly noticeable. These people try to introduce the idea that scientific uncertainty, plus or minus a few percent, is equivalent to doubt about the whole thing. This is perfectly analogous to the cigarette industry and cancer. Trying to introduce the idea that since you can't prove any one thing, the whole thing is in doubt.
As a consumer reporter, just hang on one second, Mark, I'll give you a shot. As a consumer reporter, I've covered 1,000 scares. Lawn chemicals, cell phone radiation, sure. Pesticide residues, plastic bottles killing people, power lines, mad cow disease was going to kill everybody. And always the example is, yeah, there were doubters about cigarettes. I mean, that one example doesn't mean that the global warming scare is correct. But, Mark, I should let you speak.
Yeah, for him to bring up cigarettes, I mean, the global warming scientists are the ones fulfilling a narrative. I mean, we have Michael Oppenheimer, one of the lead UN scientists, took an endowment from Barbara Streisand. He's the climatologist to the stars.
Well, they got to get money from this. Barbara Streisand wants to give me money. I'll take it.
Right, but it's so insulting to imply that somehow skeptical scientists are on the pay like tobacco companies. It's the height of arrogance when you look at the actual data. The global warming scientists, through government grants, foundations, through media empowerment, have the full advantages of government money, foundation money, university money. There's not even any comparison. And yet, these skeptical scientists, as their numbers have grown, we've had scientists like James Lovelock, who the inventor of the Gaia Earth theory, who's reversed himself.
But a lot of climate scientists, serious ones, are genuinely worried.
The ones you always point to with these genuine climate scientists are from the United Nations. And the United Nations, the head of it, Rajendra Pachauri, has just came out last year, the year before, and said their mission is to make the case that CO2 is driving global warming. They put the cart before the horse. And what happened was many UN scientists have now turned on it. Leonard Bergstedt, a Swedish scientist, has just come out and said, wouldn't even have noticed the warming of the 20th century if it weren't for modern instrumentation. And the idea of the hockey stick that Bill Nye mentioned is absurd. That has been called, quote, statistical rubbish, unquote. And hundreds of scientists and dozens of studies have shown both the medieval and the Roman warming period, and these are appeared in peer-reviewed journals, were as warm or warmer than current temperatures.
Bill?
See if we can agree about this. There used to be 1 billion people a couple centuries ago. Now there are 7 billion.
We agree on that. And the air is cleaner and people are living better and fewer people are starving.
I'll just leave it there. I encourage you to watch the entire debate. It goes on for about another 10-15 minutes. I think it's really instructive to see how this guy, Bill Nye, uses this argument of the Malthusian fear of population growth in a very vague and generalized way. And this is actually a tactic of a collectivist kind of meme, which says, you know, because there is this terrible looming problem, we've got to take desperate measures. And it almost leaves it ambiguous to leave the government or the ruling powers open to basically do whatever they must do. In other words, you're going to have to make big sacrifices. It's like Mao and the Cultural Revolution. It's the same sort of concept. We're going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And the topic is climate change. And I'm just engaging here with the mindset of those who are convinced that there is a terrible disaster looming. The mindset is one of Malthusian fears. Of course, Thomas Malthus, the contemporary of Charles Darwin, who invented the concept of catastrophic population growth as a terrible thing to be afraid of. And the elites of the world have been worried about this ever since, ladies and gentlemen. Population growth has been something that actually terrifies them, because I think the main reason being that it actually undermines their own power and control. It's much harder for tiny groups of elites to run the world in a world that is more densely populated. The more the population increases, the less tendency there is for power to be able to be concentrated in these groups. And what we are seeing now, I believe, with sort of mass awakening, as Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about, the mass awakening that's happening all over the world, is that it's largely due to population growth those elites, those groups of nepotistic inbred elites who do actually own most of the property and control the banks and control the money system, they are losing their grip. And so we have memes like climate change, which is kind of a front or a mask for actually a population growth, which is actually a front for fear about those who run the world being overrun and losing their power. And of course, they use this concept of, the environment, conservation, and, you know, you've got to preserve the planet and save the planet, to sucker you in to their agenda that's actually just about fluffing up their own power base. And, of course, a part of that involves controlling the media, controlling perceptions, and stamping out dissent. And I've got another article here from Joanne Nova. Science paper doubts IPCC, so whole journal gets terminated. I mean, this is quite extraordinary, folks. The scientific journal Pattern Recognition in Physics has been unexpectedly terminated. And the reason why it was terminated was because of one particular issue of the magazine. It's a fully peer-reviewed, proper scientific journal, but in one particular journal, they had a series of articles which looked at the effects of solar radiation, and the title of the issue was Patterns in Solar Variability, Their Planetary Origin and Terrestrial Impacts. Many of the individual papers in this issue doubt the continued and accelerated warning as claimed by the IPCC project. And this publication was put forth by Copernicus Publications, but they decided to terminate the entire journal. And, I mean, it really is quite extraordinary, isn't it? And you'll find all the details here. I'll put the links to it on our show notes. But they more or less admit that they did it because it was inappropriate, yes. Ideologically unsound. They basically just say that that they don't question the data. They're not saying it's wrong. They're not saying it's a bad science. Nothing like that. They're just saying basically this is not information that should go out, and we think we have a duty to somehow protect the world or protect our readership from this information, which could be dangerous. I mean, this is literally the way they phrase it. And you're thinking, well, hang on. It's science, right? You're not refuting it. I mean, the way to deal with something that's wrong is you refute it. You publish another paper that says, well, everything in that paper was wrong. Here are the reasons why. But no, they don't do that. They just say, well, we're not going to publish anything more. We're just going to cancel the whole thing. We're just going to be big party poopers. Of course, we've seen in other cases where the scientific establishment elites don't like a topic. They've had papers retracted, which is what happened to Anthony... my encyclopedic memory is failing me. Andrew Wakefield. Sorry about that. Yes, Andrew Wakefield, highly respected surgeon and researcher, whose article was published in The Lancet, had his paper retracted. And again, not refuted, another paper comes out and says, well, what you've said in this paper is wrong. Just, no, we're retracting it. You did something that was naughty. You're a bad person. And it turned out that what he did was naughty was he took blood samples from children at a birthday party. Oh, shock, horror. Anyway, just another example there of how corrupt and ridiculous the scientific fraternity is. And, you know, I really wish that all the different campaigners and all the different individual thinkers out there and dissidents could come together to understand how much they do indeed have in common. Because I know the vaccine, anti-vaccine lobby often is put into a little box all of its own. And a lot of the climate change skeptics probably distance themselves from vaccine skeptics because they think, well, you're anti-science. But what they don't realize is that there is actually a lot of science behind questioning vaccines. And again, I do refer you to Andrew Wakefield for clarification on that. I think it's very important, in fact, it's becoming urgent, really, that dissidents, those who have a very important and principled stance that goes against the mainstream in scientific topics, start to understand what they do have in common. And again, I would encourage the Greens and other environmentalists who are opposed to coal seam gas understand what they have in common, because they are indeed taking a sceptical position with relation to the government's position that coal seam gas is totally safe. There's no real problem with it. You know, the water table is safe. It doesn't cause poisoning and doesn't cause any problems. And again, the government brings experts and the industry experts that are wheeled out to say that everything's fine, you know, nothing to see here, move along. And, you know, we have groups of very, very passionate activists who are against coal seam gas, but those same activists will then be pro climate change alarmism. They'll be supporting the carbon tax. They'll be supporting economically destructive measures, even environmentally dubious things like windmills, which cause sound pollution and kill birds and bats. So, you know, there is so much that all of us who are questioning the authorities in different topics do have in common, but we are often divided by perceiving the other as in some category that we have learned to, perceive as being an outsider, when we, in fact, are outsiders ourselves. It's quite an interesting situation, and doing this show, because I'm kind of looking across all topics, I'm able to really see it, whereas a lot of people who are, you know, deeply involved in, say, one cause never get to see it. But then, of course, there are a lot of people who are, you know, in my view, concerned or a bit carried away with things that aren't real, and I've spent some time on my show talking about that as well. And so no doubt some people will accuse me of being someone who pigeonholes others. And of course, you know, you're free to do that. the beauty of a free society is we can say whatever we want, and we can even make false allegations about other people. But what I believe is that consistency and persistency over time is what an audience and what society in general looks for when they're trying to evaluate whether an individual is telling the truth or whether that person is some sort of charlatan. So I've tried to be pretty consistent, and also at the same time willing to say I'll change my opinion if the facts change. We are going to break. We'll be back for one last segment. Do stay with us. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Well, I'd like to finish off this week's show by talking a little bit about the political crisis in Thailand, which I've discussed previously on the show. I've been in Thailand on and off recently, and I'm slightly amazed at the lack of coverage in Western news about what is going on there. Although I shouldn't be amazed, I should be really quite used to the phenomenon of the media in the West either ignoring the most important stories or completely misrepresenting them. But indeed, what is actually happening in Thailand is of enormous importance, and it is an incredibly large mass awakening. It is about a grassroots movement of people across all walks of life, mainly from urban Thai society, but bear in mind that Thailand only has one major city, which is Bangkok. The other towns are all much, much smaller, and Thailand is a very large rural area. But the urban population is very, very large, and that is the hub of the country, and it is the hub of industry in Thailand, and it is, you know, it is the urban people of Thailand who are, I guess, the engine that has made Thailand such a incredibly successful economic success story of Southeast Asia over the past few years. And as we often see in history, when you get an educated urban elite developing in any free market societies such as what we see in Thailand, it tends to have a liberating effect. It tends to awaken deeper longings. There's like a hierarchy of needs, which I think is actually sparked when to a higher level as people improve their material circumstances, and people start to really really be concerned about principles. They start to really be concerned about things like corruption and nepotism in politics, and you know, they won't stand for it. And this is actually what's happened in Thailand, is that the government that is in power now, which is inherited from a previous government led by two members of the same family, currently Yingluck Shinawatra, the sister of Thaksin Shinawatra, who was the prime minister from 2001 to 2006. It's been described as a nepotistic regime, and this family is incredibly rich, incredibly powerful. They've managed to co-opt entire political movements to basically keep themselves in power, and they've managed to buy the loyalty of the rural population, which is seen by those who are currently protesting the government as a completely dishonest and unconstitutional tactic, because they're basically buying votes. The current regime has also been implicated in other unconstitutional activity, such as selling off Thai assets, changing the laws about acquiring land in Thailand, and privatizing the national resources of Thailand. Now, when Thaksin Shinawatra was the prime minister, he was very closely tied in with the U.S. government, the War on Terror, there was a ruthless crackdown on Islamic groups in Thailand during that time. There were actually massacres which took place, which were under the control of the Thai police, and many Islamists were actually herded into trucks and suffocated in most appalling mass killings. There were also mass killings of people who were tied to the drug trade, but then it turned out later that many of these people who were killed were simply innocent bystanders. It was just a killing spree that the police were engaged in, which, again, was all under the supervision of Thaksin Shinawatra. And, of course, this type of activity tends to drive up the price of illicit drugs, and it tends to be the tactic that's actually used by the most corrupt and truly wicked of dictators. We saw then the overthrow of the regime. Thaksin Shinawatra had been convicted of various crimes, and the military actually stepped in. And one thing that people often don't understand in Thailand is that the role of the military in Thailand has actually been historically very favourable to the people, very favourable to the needs and the self-determination of Thai people. And the intervention of the military in deposing Thaksin Shinawat in 2006 is regarded by most Thai people that I've spoken to as being a good thing, although it was represented in the Western media as a military coup and therefore a bad thing. After he was deposed, he actually fled the country. He was convicted and should actually be serving a prison sentence. But he fled the country and then built a mass movement known as the Red Shirts, who then came back in a resurgence of a new political party, which was then became quite a dominant force in Thai politics and was being led by Thaksin Shinawatra from overseas. And it actually led, in the end, to that party winning another election, and this time led by his own sister. A most peculiar situation. And the dissatisfaction with the government, the feeling that the government is engaging in corrupt activities, has continued really throughout the regime of Yingluck Shinawatra. And what triggered this massive upheaval that we now see, and just to give you an indication, the whole of Bangkok now is basically in gridlock because millions of people have taken to the streets and they've actually blocked in major intersections all over Bangkok. And they are demanding that the elected government of Yingluck Shinawatra step down, that Yingluck step down, and they want to enact reforms. They're not against democracy, but they feel that the government and the system needs to be reformed. They feel that another election will not lead to a truly democratic result. What triggered all of this was an amnesty bill, which had been put forward by the ruling party here to basically allow Thaksin Shinawatra back into the country. And of course that was just a red flag, you know, to a bull, to the Thai people who see him as a criminal. There is a belief that he has offended the king as well. There is a great respect and honouring of the king in Thailand, which really cannot be underestimated in its importance historically and culturally. It goes back many hundreds of years, and there is a feeling among Thai people that the regime that is in power and those who back it are trying to undermine the power of the king. So when this amnesty bill was put through the parliament, it created an uproar in Bangkok, and this new protest movement suddenly sprung up, and it grew and grew and grew, and Then the government, in a knee-jerk response, announced that there would be elections, but the protest leader, Sutep, said that the elections were unacceptable, that basically there needed to be reforms to the country before any elections could be seen as being free and fair. But the government simply ignored that and has pressed ahead with the elections. In the meantime, this massive protest movement then took to the streets. They created what they called Occupy Bangkok movement. They've now blocked intersections all over Bangkok. And what is happening is the government is responding using tactics really of terrorism through proxies that are possibly being brought in from overseas. And we are seeing attacks on the protesters taking place now increasingly frequently. We've actually seen grenade attacks on the protesters in Bangkok. We've seen one of the protest leaders gunned down in broad daylight. And we are now seeing the use of grenade launchers. And, I mean, this is quite an extraordinary development in a situation where you have entirely peaceful protesters. I mean, this is nothing like what has been taking place in Syria, where you actually had a very heavily armed insurgency that basically was trying to overthrow a government. This is just a group of incredibly peaceful people of all walks of life who are staging a sit-in using the very peaceful, non-violent technique that really was pioneered by people like Gandhi to try and bring about a better outcome for the people of Thailand. I've just got an article here from the 29th of January from Alt Thai News by Tony Cartolucci. Thaksin Shinawatra's proxy regime currently ruling in Thailand have again attacked protesters, this time with a deadly 40mm M79 grenade launcher, a weapon of war used extensively by pro-Thaksin terrorists in violence that left 92 dead in Bangkok in 2010. And a report here from Thai PBS says the protest site of the Network of Students and People for the Reform of Thailand was attacked before dawn, causing injury to a protester. And, of course, we saw the murder of a protest leader a couple of days ago, and we've seen people throwing grenades into the completely peaceful, unarmed crowds who are simply there to block the streets and try to make a better place for the average person in Thailand. Well, that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with more incisive commentary and analysis. See you then.